Welcome to Crypto Kid Podcast. So today I have a special guest, and he's a very busy guy, especially with things going on with Bitcoin skyrocketing and the market going crazy. And thank you for showing up, man. Please tell us how you got involved with cryptocurrency and blockchain technology and what motivated you to get started with this company.
Definitely. So about 10 years ago, while I was still in college, I discovered Bitcoin and took it to my professor. It was a comp sci class, and he said this thing shouldn't work, but the fact that it does is pretty incredible, so you should follow it closely. He was talking more so about the game theory and economic properties of all these adversarial actors essentially working together to maintain the price of something, which was very incredible. Luckily, I listened to him. So I got into Bitcoin. This was like around 2014, and the rest is history. It started my career in traditional tech, working at IBM, so more conservative, and then recently made the jump onto crypto. This was, you know, right before FTX and everything imploded. This is like around 2021. And really the promise of crypto and DeFi more generally, just programmable money, is to give people the ability to transact peer-to-peer without intermediaries. And that's huge. Just like we can send an email or a text message to each other through relay networks on the internet. Now we can do that with Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other assets. The programmability of it is also pretty incredible. Right now we're building all these financial applications, but pretty soon we'll be able to see, you know, any Web 2 app translated into a Web 3 app. Uber Eats, Tinder, whatever. I think all this stuff can be put on chain so that there's no intermediaries essentially extracting value. So yeah, it's been over 10 years. A bit of like a Bitcoin maxi, but you know, also realistic on how do we drive adoption in these high performance chains like Aptos, Sui, Solana. So yeah, excited to share more about what we're building.
Great. Good deal. Yeah, it was exciting times back in the day. And dude, I just watched literally a documentary about Jimmy. I forget how to pronounce his last name, but he like literally did the biggest heist with Bitcoin off Silk Road. And it's funny because the reason why I bring that up, it was supposed to be an anonymous, like no one was supposed to know like who took these Bitcoins. And eventually like the IRS and like a founder of a blockchain company got together and they collaborated and they ended up finding them. You know what I'm talking about, right? Or
is it Ross Ulbricht?
No. His name is Jimmy. Let me see. I'll pull it up real quick.
I can talk about Ross Ulbricht. He was the creator of the Silk Road. Definitely a very interesting character. I don't know if you heard about him.
Yeah, I did. But it was a guy that he used to go on there and he used to buy like cocaine off Silk Road. And then he was like really, I forget his name, but if you get a chance, just YouTube the biggest Bitcoin heist. And this is a young guy and he went to the University of Georgia and things like that. And he had like $3.8 billion of Bitcoin at the time in like 2021 or two. So about a couple of years ago. So it was
a guy that, essentially, he had $8 billion in Bitcoin. And when they found him, it was stashed like in his closet or something.
Yeah. That's amazing. But yeah, let's talk about your company. I just thought that was kind of cool and bring that up. And I just saw that. Yeah, I mean, so
I'm happy to go down these tangents. Ross Ulbricht is like a very interesting one because there was a lot of corruption around his case. I believe like some of the DEA agents or some of the federal agents that were investigating him also like stole money and kind of like set him up. And it seems like he was literally railroaded. I remember listening to a podcast, I think it was called Railroaded, and it was about Ross Ulbricht. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure he was involved, but the fact that they gave him like three life sentences just seems you know, not really applicable to the crime. And like even like, you know, what they got him on for, like, quote unquote, I think it was like hiring someone to kill someone else. That was like kind of like a setup. So it also seems like entrapment. And yeah, I mean, super interesting. It's like they can't even prove that it was actually him because they're just tying it to this pseudonymous identity, Dread Pirate Roberts. But yeah, that's a super interesting story. There's so much crypto lore. That's like one of the early ones. But yeah, I don't know. That was like an interesting one. Yeah, I mean, the people don't realize that on the blockchain, everything is there. Like, it's just a public ledger. So yeah, if you're committing crimes or, you know, like hiring people to kill their people, then, you know, it's all going to be there.
Oh yeah, it all comes back. Okay, so I found the name. His name is Jimmy Sohong. Like, his real name is James, but they did a whole documentary literally on was it ABC artists? Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
James on. And yeah, I'll put the link in the description. And is the name of the video is How to Steal and Lose More Than $3 billion in Bitcoin, a CNBC documentary. And that was like uploaded like 5 months ago.
Oh wow. I do remember Jimmy Song. I've actually met him in person. I don't know. He was like, what was the name? Could you re-say that? How to
steal and lose more than $3 billion in Bitcoin.
I don't think this is the same Jimmy Song. Like, he doesn't wear a cowboy hat. Okay. They're both named Jimmy. But anyway, okay. Yeah. Interesting. I'll look into it. Oh yeah, I know. Yeah. I think I've heard of this guy, not the same Jimmy Song that I referenced. But yeah, man, I think crypto's the Wild West. It seems to be institutionalizing a lot more, and you know, just bringing real people, the real builders into the space, hopefully carries that forward.
For sure. For sure. And now with more regulations, everything's going to like start, you know, like people are going to start trusting the blockchain a lot more. And like literally the other day, I was on Facebook Marketplace and I was selling like marine signs, and I was like, I'll accept cryptocurrency. He's like, sounds like a scam, and then immediately blocks me or leaves a group chat. I'm like, come on, dude, it's not a scam. And my girlfriend's like literally making fun of me. It's like, you're a scammer. I was like, no, I'm not. That's how I accept payment when I sell things on Facebook Marketplace. So
yeah, I mean, if most of the world still thinks it's a scam, that's somewhat bullish given the traction, right? What happens when it becomes more normalized and most people don't think it's a scam? I would imagine as an asset class, similar to stocks or cash or gold, the stores of value, like most people are going to want some exposure to crypto. So that's going to be first. Seems like it's first going to be institutions. You're going to see probably like family funds, family offices, like small family offices, all the way up to the big funds like BlackRock, just start to get more and more allocations into Bitcoin. And the fixed supply is just basic supply demand. It's a deflationary asset. People lose their Bitcoin. And demand is just going to keep going up. And that fixed supply in the exchanges and OTC desks is just going to be hit with increasing demand from institutions and then eventually more retail. And that also boils into institutions. So, yeah, I mean, I think people are going to get like a hard lesson on supply and demand economics once the price of Bitcoin continues shooting up. I think the 7 trillion, which is gold, is like very attainable at this point. You know, it's not too far away. And yeah, especially, so this was an issue with all the lenders, like BlockFi and FTX and Celsius, where the Bitcoin was being rehypothecated. Essentially, there's no way to get 6%, these like, you know, 10% rates without, doing, essentially under collateralized or in some instances uncollateralized lending. So this Bitcoin was essentially just paper Bitcoin, and that caused a lot of leverage to build up in the system. And, you know, obviously a lot of people got wrecked. You know, FTX stole funds to cover their, you know, to cover their holes in their balance sheet. But this means that a lot of these are not back up, which means that Bitcoin is not being rehypothecated. So if people actually want Bitcoin, they need to like actually have Bitcoin. So again, that's only going to keep pushing the price up as the supply is very much fixed. So yeah, excited to see that play. The happening is coming, and you know, I think people will realize like, oh wow, like this is literally like laws of physics. Price, supply and demand is just physics.
For sure, for sure. And I noticed like with the EFTs or ETFs, like Bitcoin started going up after that started happening. And then like we have, what is it, other countries like El Salvador that are taking major interest, or that have a major interest in using it as a currency for the whole entire country, which is amazing, because like now this really puts cryptocurrency on the board with other countries to use. And like with, I don't know if you heard of BRICS, but it's like alliance with Russia, China, India, South Africa. Now they're starting to look at to use blockchain technology, and they're trying to step away from the US dollar. So that, I think that's going to make them a serious competitor with the United States, and honestly make us sweat if you're from the United States, like make you sweat a little bit, like, okay, like maybe we're going to lose a little bit of ground. We need to catch up here, or else we're going to be left behind. So.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much every empire that the world has known has fallen. You know, I don't think that history won't repeat itself with the US. Like, it seems almost unlikely that the US will be around for infinity. Whereas hard assets like gold and silver have been a unit of account and essentially money, a currency, for thousands of years, if not longer, at least like as far back as we can go into, you know, history, like Greece, they were using coins. And it's a, I mean, so when you look at the history of money, probably stem from debts that people owed each other. So, for example, and these are like human debts, like, oh, you killed my brother. And then the tribe must say, you know, we must kill one of your brethren. Mm-hmm. But then eventually we civilize a little bit, like, okay, well, maybe your brother's worth, you know, $1 million or whatever, so just pay this fine. Similar with dowries, you know, your wife, you know, you're marrying my daughter, you know, like, pay me this much. And, you know, those debts kind of evolved into units of account. If you look at the Sumerians, they were keeping track of the farmers and people, you know, creating useful utilities in the world, like, I don't know, paper and food. And in simple record keeping, they're just keeping track of this with, you know, tabulations. And then, you know, obviously we know about like seashells and stuff like that, but like hard money is stuff that can be replicated. And, you know, eventually, naturally, we started using these precious metals like gold, silver, because it's like hard to get. And, you know, kind of thinking about Bitcoin as a standard, or just, again, like a maybe like emerging property of humans, where we just self-organize around value. Then if we can extrapolate Bitcoin being around for eternity, then it should outlast, you know, something like the US government, or, you know, any government, and become a unit of account. I think as the world globalizes through the internet and, you know, quote unquote, the metaverse, and we just kind of like realize the simulation might already be here. I think these digital currencies definitely have a huge role to play in transitioning us from these fiat government backed currencies, which, by the way, up until the 1970s, were the US dollar was backed by gold. So it's only like a recent experiment of free floating fiat currencies. And, you know, we've had tons of inflation ever since then, so not sure how long it'll last. But yeah, I mean, a large part of the hegemony that the US dollar has is due to the petrodollar, you know, like the oil being denominated in US dollars, and our alliances in the Middle East there to, you know, ensure that continues. But that's also, you know, maybe becoming weaker, and, you know, maybe these international entities want, you know, some independence from the US. So yeah, I think we'll probably continue seeing this decline, and I don't think like it'll eventually go away, but, you know, it's kind of like, let's say Google or whatever is like the top of the S&P 500, but maybe eventually it becomes somewhere in the middle as new companies enter. I think similarly currencies are going to play that role. And, you know, I'm definitely, you know, full-hearted American and believe in America, but, you know, I think there should be more competition on the currency side. And I think Bitcoin and maybe ETH and some others are definitely a good competitor here.
For sure. For sure. Now, what concerns me, honestly, like, yeah, all this technology is good, and like it could help and be really useful to people. But what happens like when the power grid goes out, or like when there's nothing, like you can't access anything, and all you have is like all you have what's ever in your hand, like what you were saying about precious metal or fiat currency and things like that. How is Bitcoin going to still stay in the game if something catastrophic happened like that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Theoretically, you could even send Bitcoin through smoke signals. All you need to do is essentially coordinate different machines. So even if the internet were to go down, you should still be able to theoretically send Bitcoin. Could be through like mesh networks of maybe like Bluetooth or connections. But yeah, like as long as you are able to send information from one party to another, it could be a piece of paper, it could be smoke signals, as I said, it should theoretically work. But yeah, I mean, to your point, when shit hits the fan, let's say like World War III breaks out and, you know, the nukes go off. Yeah, I doubt much other than like food and shelter is going to have any value in the areas where, you know, the stuff gets hit. But we can look at history, like not too long ago, World War II broke out. And yeah, a lot of people, you know, had gold and jewelry, and that's what they were able to, you know, stash out and, you know, immigrate into America and other places. So yeah, I mean, definitely don't put, you know, still maintain some gold, you know, don't put all your value in Bitcoin, but, you know, assuming we can still send information to each other, you know, Bitcoin might still survive even like a catastrophic event. But yeah, I mean, think about it this way too. It becomes a matter of national security to protect the Bitcoin miners if our infrastructure is relying on it. So like if, you know, a lot of our wealth as a country, especially through these proxies of the US government, like BlackRock and, you know, other large entities start acquiring Bitcoin, and you know, a state level actor or an adversarial wants to attack that, then, you know, they could attack the miners, and then that becomes a matter of national security to protect the Bitcoin miners. But yeah, I mean, hopefully that doesn't come to fruition, but definitely something to think about as we integrate this into our economy and in more integral ways. How do we protect the Bitcoin?
Okay. Now, do you think Bitcoin's still going to have a stronghold if the United States were to have a great recession, or if the economy were to go down?
Yeah, so Bitcoin, interestingly enough, does well. I think it's been doing well, whether there's lower interest rates, which makes all stocks, especially tech stocks, you know, go up. We've been seeing this, you know, tracking NVIDIA and some of the other high tech stocks. And it's also a store of value. So this is what makes it really interesting from a modern portfolio theory, where you want as much diversification or as much uncorrelated assets as possible in your portfolio. Bitcoin is sometimes acts like a store of value, goes up with gold and other precious metals, and then sometimes acts like a tech stock, goes up with NVIDIA and other tech stocks. So yeah, as a hedge against inflation, or as a hedge against, you know, shit hitting the fan, I think Bitcoin, you know, does have those properties. And if the interest rates continue to go up, you know, the money printer continues to go burr, then also seems like Bitcoin will go up. So no matter which way you look at it, Bitcoin seems like a good bet.
So what do you think?
Don't buy Bitcoin based on this. It's not financial advice.
Yeah, it's never, always do your own due diligence for sure. But what do you suggest people, how do you suggest people to store their assets, their digital currency? Like, what would be a safe way to protect them from hackers? Like, I'll give you a quick story. Back in like 2017, when Bitcoin was going back up and it was reaching mainstream media, my friend and I, now he's my brother-in-law. Ain't that funny? But anyways, so he ended up spending his credit card all on these cryptocurrencies. And then it was in, Doge or Dodge? And he had like millions of coins. And that was back when it was worth less than a penny. And then his account got hacked. And he was like, man, what the fuck? He's like, now I have to pay all these credit cards. And I don't have no cryptos. What?
It was on an exchange that he got hacked, or?
I forgot which exchange it was.
The coins in the exchange.
What's that?
You had the coins in an exchange?
Yeah, he did. He did. And one of the exchanges got hacked. I got to ask him which one it was. But
yeah, I mean, the lesson there is not your keys, not your crypto, right? If you're not custodying your own keys, then you're trusting someone else to do so. there are trusted custodians. I think there are, you know, like Coinbase Custody is a trusted custodian. You know, BitGo and some of the other ones are definitely trusted. Actually, I don't know about, I think Bitcoin might have some issues, but there should be some trusted custodians. I think banks may eventually start to custody assets. So yeah, if you don't trust yourself to be able to custody your own private keys safely, there's definitely, Casa is a good one. It's like, I believe it's a multi-sig that allows you to custody your own assets through a multi-sig, but there are solutions out there that make it a lot easier to custody your assets, but leaving them on exchange is definitely the worst. You know, maybe like Coinbase, you could leave something there. But I mean, we all saw what happened to FTX, right? Like, you're just giving your coins to someone to hold. And, you know, going back to the point I made earlier is that, you know, the goal of crypto is for you to just have self-sovereignty over your money. So when you're giving it to an exchange, you know, you're having to trust a third party. But yeah, I think multi-sig, definitely hardware wallets. These are all tools that make it easier to custody your own assets. You know, especially, you know, as an American, like if you have stuff in your home, like, I don't know, probably want to get a gun or something, you know, cause like literally it's like storing gold under your mattress. But yeah, I mean, not your keys, not your crypto, you're in full responsibility of your assets, or you can give it to someone else that is trustworthy, but make sure that those parties like custodians are really trustworthy and have insurance, et cetera, in case things go wrong.
For sure. Don't want anything to happen. Yeah. My girlfriend asks me, she's like, do you ever check your accounts? I was like, yes and no. I do check, but I don't want to go crazy over keep looking at it. And she's like, why don't you? And I was like, I don't know. I'm just honestly just treating it like as a life insurance policy. Like when things really go bad, because I just feel like that's going to be there in the long run for me. I'm not like really looking at making the fast buck or fast dollar. I just, this is the thing I truly believe in, and that's going to stay here for the rest of mankind. And I completely lost faith in a dollar. Like, yeah, right now everything runs off the dollar, especially when you live here in the United States and we need it for our day-to-day goods and things like that. But when it comes to like basing my trust on it, no, I don't have trust in the dollar at all. And that's just something I have that helps my life make me more comfortable today. But like, I want to do better in the future. So this is why I have cryptocurrencies. And like with XRP and what you're saying, like with banks adopting cryptocurrencies, I honestly believe that Ripple is going to be like the first that banks are going to adopt into their system and be really acceptant. And they're getting pretty close. They've been having hard times with the SEC and things like that, but the CEO there, he's really great. He's a fighter, honestly. He's just like, you know, we're going to take this head on and find answers to our problems, you know, make solutions. And yeah, so you have any thoughts about that? Or
yeah, I mean, I'm not super familiar with XRP, but what I would say is from a regulatory perspective, as you're saying, you know, they're having challenges with the SEC. I think the XRP as like a fast blockchain for payments, like makes sense. You know, maybe Solana, Aptos, Sui, you know, also makes sense just like as a way to send payments in between third parties. That's like really fast and cheap. What I'm thinking about Bitcoin and ETH as being adopted is more so like as an asset that can be custodied. So like, just like you can store dollars at your bank, you would hope that in the future you could also store Bitcoin, and that would be, you know, insured in some capacity. Just because Bitcoin and maybe ETH in the near future are already accepted commodities, you know, from a regulatory perspective, Bitcoin now has an ETF. So that's, you know, relatively trustworthy as an asset. It's like the most important part about a commodity is that it's decentralized, that you don't have, you know, like any one individual party that can control it or has information asymmetry that can wreck traders. You know, commodities markets can definitely still be manipulated and like all this stuff still applies. but at least Bitcoin is like big enough and decentralized enough where, you know, no one party can easily control it. So I think that's why it's reached that. I think ETH will probably reach that. XRP, you know, I'm not super familiar, but I think there's like a huge amount locked up still, right, from like the foundation or, you know, the main people there. But yeah, I mean, the systems for blockchains for sending payments make sense. And I think banks will adopt it. You know, I think Solana might be a good one, Aptos, Sui, as like high performance, low cost ones that are being heavily used today and, you know, are getting traction. In regards to the US dollar maintaining value, I mean, I think the US dollar has a premium on liquidity and acceptance. Like, you need it to pay your taxes. And, you know, everywhere in the US and most of the world, people accept dollars. But, you know, in the near future, maybe that could be the case for Bitcoin, right? Like you're saying, in El Salvador and some of these emerging countries, you can even like pay your taxes in Bitcoin. And as long as it's liquid and fungible and, you know, tradable with other assets, then, you know, I don't see why people wouldn't, like, especially people, including governments, wouldn't want to accept it as a store value or as a medium of exchange. And then naturally, organically, we'll, you know, start to move towards that direction. Like, one thing to think about is, like, a lot of people hold their value in stocks, but it's not like you pay for coffee in stocks. But, like, why not? You know, like, if your savings, like, right now, your savings account, you could be connected to your, you know, credit card or whatever. So imagine, like, you know, you have your credit card, and then every time you pay your credit card, you pay it off from your savings. Like, why isn't there, like, why can't you just pay with your Robinhood account? Why can't you just pay your credit card? Obviously, you know, you'll incur taxes for, you know, capital gains or whatever. But if you wanted to, like, other than, you know, literally going through the process of selling your assets and paying the credit card off, like, you know, withdrawing or whatever. Sorry about that.
You're good.
But yeah, other than that, you know, you should theoretically be able to. So that's possible with crypto. Like, just keep your crypto, and then whenever you want to pay your credit card, you know, you could. And again, if Bitcoin or ETH or whatever has you know, more of the properties that people value in money, so store value, medium of exchange, I think unit account will be hard, you know, because again, you need to pay your taxes and whatever currency your government accepts. But you know, I don't see, like, a lot of these credit cards, for example, that are connected to crypto where you get rewards or whatever, you know, you could theoretically also pay with it. I think the tax component needs to be worked out a little bit easier. But yeah, like, if you're keeping most of your net worth in crypto and then you need to pay your credit card, like, there should just be like an easy way to do that. And I think that's going to become ever more possible with tooling. So yeah, we'll like slowly orange pill the world as they just like keep more of their value in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So yeah, curious to see how that plays out.
So tell me about some of the projects that you're working on. Like, what are things that you're helping that come true?
Yeah, right now the major project that we're working on is called Lumio. So just for background, and, you know, 30 minutes in, finally talking about what we're doing. So for background, we built out two major applications on Aptos. Aptos is an alternative L1 that uses the Move language. It was started by the same people that built Libra and Diem at Facebook. It's a fork of that project, Diem. We built out the top wallet, the top AMM. And what we were doing now is essentially enabling ourselves and other projects from other L1s like Solana, be able to just migrate their code or copy paste their code. So, you know, just for background for people in the audience, on Ethereum, you need to have your code be compatible with the what's called the operating system or the virtual machine, which is called the Ethereum virtual machine. And you can build with Solidity, or you can build with Viper. It's like another language, but Solidity is the more popular one. And Solidity is literally a made-up language. It was built specifically for Ethereum, for the Ethereum virtual machine. And, you know, I mean, technically there's like nothing like terribly wrong with it. It's brought us so far, but it just doesn't feel right. It feels kind of janky. So, for example, formal verification, which is a way to make sure that your smart contracts or software is outputting exactly what you meant that for outputting is done through what is called a prover. And on Ethereum, you can pull in third-party libraries to do this formal verification. But on newer virtual machines like Move, it's built into the virtual machine, so you can do these, you can do this proving natively within the virtual machine. So it just feels like a better user experience. Similarly, upgradability to smart contracts is something that is relatively common. You know, hopefully most DeFi protocols don't have upgradability, because upgradability is essentially a backdoor to the code. Like, devs can upgrade your code and literally withdraw all the funds that are there. But anyways, like integrations or other smart contracts maybe need upgradability. And on Ethereum, you need to call what are called proxy contracts. And again, it just feels janky to create another thing to be able to do something that could be done natively. Whereas on Move, you can just deploy your code to be, you know, upgradable, and that works natively. The EVM is also sequential. So maybe people have heard of this key term, parallelization. So parallelized EVM is, you know, like a hype trend. What that really means is that you can run transactions in parallel across various cores on the machine. On the normal EVM, each transaction has to be done sequentially. Whereas on parallelized EVMs or on the Solana VM or Move VM, you get this native parallelization for the transactions. The Move virtual machine, which we're working on Aptos, has what is called optimistic concurrency. And then comparing that to pessimistic concurrency, which is on Solana, on pessimistic concurrency, you essentially have to, prior to running the code, you have to specify which slots in memory you might use. And then all of those get locked up. Whereas optimistic concurrency, you don't have to specify which ones are going to get locked up. So you get better performance out of it. So small iterative improvements over what's existing. Similarly, analogous on traditional Web 2 is essentially the new language Rust. So Rust is, even though not as widely used as C and other low-level languages, Rust is becoming very quickly one of the most popular languages. People really like it. How it manages resources is becoming super popular. The Solana VM uses Rust. Move is designed after Rust. So as more traditional tech developers enter the space, they're going to want what they're used to. These are, you know, literally mission production grade for mission critical infrastructure. Banks, our phones, everything, you know, is starting to run on Rust. So, you know, we should expect the same from our smart contracts and our blockchain infrastructure. But right now on Ethereum, we're vendor locked into the EVM. So essentially what we're building is a way to get rid of that monopoly, that hegemony, similar to the US dollar. The EVM has a hegemony on Ethereum, and it really doesn't need to exist. We want to build a way to credibly neutral, in a credible neutral way, deploy these alternative VM applications. So all the products we built on Aptos, we can just copy paste the code and deploy on Ethereum. Similarly, teams on Solana can just copy paste their code and deploy on Ethereum. And then over time, they don't have to maintain the technical depth of, for example, having an EVM implementation, a Solana implementation, a Move implementation. They can just have everything in one language, and that enables them to not carry on this technical debt. You also get all the benefits of these new virtual machines on Ethereum. And yeah, I mean, Ethereum, many refer to it. This is something that people refer to Ethereum as the infinite garden, where it's just an open garden. People can come in, plant their seeds, and others, you know, build around it and grows organically. And it's really permissionless. Anybody can build. So as part of Ethereum's infinite garden, we're planting the seeds for these alternative VM applications to be able to deploy. So yeah, that's essentially what Lumio is doing. The way that we're implementing this is on the layer two stack. So working closely with existing L2s that have essentially already set the path for scalability and execution on the L2 layer. So Optimism, Arbitrum, some of the ZK ones like ZK Zinc, Scroll, Polygon have done a lot of work. The way that L2s work, for those in the audience that are not familiar, is you need to prove. So a layer two is essentially just a computer that's running off chain. It's off chain computations. And then you need to prove that those computations happen on chain. So you can run a bunch of transactions on smart contracts, quote unquote, off chain. and then batch process them, compress them, and put them into the L1 as call data, so that you can essentially prove that they happen in this off-chain. So this means that you can theoretically infinitely scale, because you can have infinite off-chain computers. Now that comes with a caveat, because there's still limited bandwidth on the L1. But yeah, I mean, essentially what these L2s are computers or servers that are off-chain. And then through what are called fraud proofs or validity proofs also known as ZK proofs, you're able to prove that the stuff that happened off-chain actually happened, and then, you know, have it be cemented into the history of the blockchain. So the way, just really quickly, the way that fraud proofs work is you post, and then there's a challenge period, normally 7 days, but it could be whatever. And then within that 7 day period, if someone proves that you're wrong, you know, you get slashed, or you get money taken away for putting these fraudulent transactions. So validity proofs, you just need to prove that it actually happened with ZK proofs. So it you know, you don't need to have this 7 day waiting period. But yeah, so Optimism, Arbitrum, ZK Zinc, Polygon, a lot of these have worked for many years on these L2 solutions. And we're very narrowly focused on the virtual machine component of what is being called modular tech stack. So the OP stack, Orbitz on Arbitrum, they're quote unquote modular. Pretty soon, even the fraud proofs, like, you know, there's research being done to even include validity proofs or ZK proofs into the OP stack. So you can essentially, you know, swap out different components like data availability. Data availability is where you make sure that the data is being stored somewhere that you can access. It means that it's always available. The virtual, so essentially we're very narrowly focused on the virtual machine component, so that you can deploy onto Optimism, Arbitrum, you know, the major L2s that are going to be around hopefully for the next 100, 2000 years, Solana VM applications, MoveVM applications, so that all these teams on Aptos, Solana, Sui, et cetera, can just copy paste their code and deploy onto Ethereum safely and trustlessly in the most credibly neutral way possible. So yeah, that's essentially what we're building, and we're on testing it out and hopefully moving into mainnet relatively soon.
Yeah, you guys are definitely a force to be reckoned with. Do you know when, can you say when exactly you guys are going to make it to mainnet, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to estimate. I don't like to make promises, but we're on testnet now. People can go on lumio.io and check it out. We're also EVM only mainnet, but the Move implementation is on testnet. So hopefully relatively soon, you know, we'll be able to work out everything needed to transition from testnet onto mainnet.
Now, is there going to be a wallet on there, or where people could store their cryptos like Polygon and Solana and all that?
Yeah, so the cool part about this for Move is that all the applications that work on Aptos can also work on this. So as I mentioned, we built out the top wallet on Aptos. That's Pontum Wallet. Also LiquidSwap, which is the top AMM. So all of these applications will be able to be compatible on Ethereum. You can test it out today. You can use Pontum Wallet, Move on Ethereum, Sepulia, Testnet. So yeah, the applications that work on Aptos, you know, will be able to also work on Ethereum.
Yeah, hear that, people? Make sure you download and start using them. Now, when you were talking about L1s and L2s, do you think there's going to be like an L3 and it's just going to keep going like a domino effect?
That's that fractal scaling or recursive scaling is definitely theoretically possible. So you're just having less guarantees the more abstracted that you go. So an L3 is going to have less guarantees than an L2, and so on and so forth. So let's say an L, you know, 10 or L infinity is going to be hyper scalable, but then it doesn't have the same guarantees as an L2 or an L1. So theoretically, yes, this is like a good way to scale, and maybe we'll move in that direction as, like, let's say the L2 gets full, you know, the L3 would start failing, etc. But yeah, I mean, there's just trade-offs to what is called finality, because you need to wait essentially for each of the layer below to reach a final state. Finality on Bitcoin, I believe, is 3 blocks or maybe 6 blocks. I think it's 3 blocks. And then each block is about 10 minutes, which is why it takes like 30 minutes for your transaction to go through. And then similarly on Ethereum, it can take a while, because finality is also kind of like a social construct. On the blockchain, what can happen is block reorganizes, or like the blockchain reorganizes. Sometimes you get like two blocks that get mined at the exact same time. You know, it's like a fairly low probability event, but it does happen. And then you get what are called orphan blocks. So, you know, not the actual block that should have been mined. Like, that's not the real blockchain. So these things can happen. And or you could have an adversarial actor try to attack the blockchain, and then they might be able to successfully attack it for one block, but they wouldn't be able to successfully attack it for two blocks, three blocks, four blocks, etc. So this is why there's like a social consensus around a certain number of blocks having gone through for us to like feel comfortable saying, okay, this is like permanently on the blockchain. You know, I think it's, and again, I could be wrong, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it's like 3 for Bitcoin, maybe like 6 for Ethereum, or maybe it's 6 for both or something like that. But yeah, that's what people call like hard finality, when you're like, you know, 99.9%, you know, certain that the blockchain is not going to reorganize and that your transaction went through. But yeah, you know, and again, the farther away you get from the L1, the more trust you need in the underlying layer for it to go through. So what you're saying can happen, but I think it'll happen as like the layers underneath get full, I guess.
Yeah, and you guys, sounds like you guys have like a lot of protection going on. Now, you brought up Rust, and is that like a Web3 kind of coding? Like a new age, like, you know, like new technology kind of way of coding, and like, a lot of more companies are starting to use them.
Yeah, so Rust is a language that is being adopted in traditional tech. So it's a low level language, which means that it interacts with the machine, let's say the server or the bare metal, or phone, a hardware device, more efficiently. And also, like, quote unquote, more safe. It's like static type, so you know, kind of exactly what it's going to output to. So Rust is actually a language that's becoming very popular in traditional tech programming. And Solana VM. So these smart contracts are essentially, technically, like, should be closer to the machine, because you're like executing on these, you know, nodes or servers. Whereas something like, I don't know, JavaScript, which is maybe used for, or maybe like CSS or something that's used for like web applications that are like, you know, abstracted from the machine. You know, it's just running on the web browser, for example, can use something that's more abstract, can have like more errors, can be more dynamic. But yeah, Rust and C and some of these low-level languages are very popular for like low level applications. Also, like, for example, like airplane hardware, you know, like when you're literally running an airplane and you need to make sure that it's efficiently, you know, the autopilot or something is like efficiently working with like, I don't know, the throttle, or, you know, the pitch of the airplane, then you probably want something that's like, you know, not going to fail and that can act, you know, pretty quickly. So that's where like these low level languages play. And yeah, they're becoming, Rust is like a relatively new one. I don't remember exactly when it started out, but it's like the growth rate of it is tremendous compared to C. You know, I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it's like double digit percentage growth versus like single digit percentage growth. And that can easily compound, where over time, you can imagine Rust overtaking C or some of these other, like C was around for a really long time. Like, I remember when I was in middle school, they made us, it was C++, but they made us learn these languages. And I think like I mean, I don't know the history of it, maybe we can look it up, but it's been around for a really long time. So yeah, sometimes these, you know, new languages pop up and they're useful enough for people to start adopting them. And I think, you know, crypto in the blockchain space is early enough where there's not that many developers, there's not that many apps, so there's still a good opportunity and for something that's, you know, objectively a lot better, like Rust or Move, to overtake an incumbent like the EVM and Solidity. So yeah, that's what we're betting on, and the tools that we're building is enabling it.
All right, awesome. So how many people are actively using your product and things like that? What's the user base?
Yeah. So on Aptos, we have around 10,000 daily active users on the wallet, and on the AMM, 10,000 unique addresses interacting. That number has been going up. It's like, volatile, but even hitting spikes of like 20,000. Fairly good user base there. These are products that are live. What's good about Aptos also is that it's fast and cheap. So, people don't need to pay like $14 per gas to send transactions. You can do like, very, very low value transactions. So, dozens of thousands of users daily, which is cool.
Did you see a difference when, since Bitcoin has gone up, maybe a lot more people are getting curious about you guys and just like, try it, why not?
That's definitely happening. There's also been a lot of price appreciation on the Aptos APT asset. So I think a lot of people are definitely rotating into this. Aptos could be, the narrative that people are saying is like, it could be the next Solana. Solana still has a lot of issues. You might've seen this on crypto Twitter recently around duplicate transactions hitting the validator. So people are having issues having their transactions go through. And it's because they don't technically have a memory pool. So then like every validator or every RPC that's receiving transactions needs to have like their own version of it. It's not standardized and it can easily get, overrun, and there's no like easy way to like organize those transactions. So a lot of people send duplicate transactions and those get dropped. On Ethereum, there's a fee market, a memory pool, where that goes, similarly on Aptos as well. So, there's just like small, and also the pessimistic concurrency, as I mentioned, there's like small iterative improvements that Aptos makes over Solana that just make the user experience a lot better. And at the end of the day, the value proposition of these alternative L1s is that they can mimic a Web2 application. So for example, buying an NFT on Bitcoin literally takes like, 30 minutes, where it's like, we're used to just going to Shopify or whatever, clicking buy, and then, you get the thing. That's possible on Solana and Aptos and these alternative L1s. But it's not possible on Bitcoin, maybe on like a Bitcoin L2 or something. But that's the main difference. The trade-off is that you don't get these native assets. So, you don't get ETH on Solana, you only get SOL. And like most people have their net worth or value in ETH and Bitcoin. So, you can use bridges, but bridges are relatively not as safe. There's been a lot of bridge hacks. Most of them are secured by like multi-sigs. So it's safer to have your native asset ETH or BTC within that chain. That's the trade-off. Also decentralization, like these alternative L1s are essentially running on way bigger servers. So it's like, it's like Ethereum, but on steroids, like literally just giant machines instead of like a Raspberry Pi, which like theoretically you could run Ethereum node on a Raspberry Pi. And that comes at the trade-off of you can be more performant, you can be cheaper, but it's less decentralized. So you potentially need to run the node on AWS or Google Cloud. And what happens if, let's say, there's like a state level actor attack on crypto where the US government and other major governments say like, okay, now crypto's illegal, you can't run it on AWS, you can't run it on Google Cloud. Like pretty quickly all these major L1s are going to go down, because like, who the hell is going to set up a giant server in their garage to run Solana or Aptos or whatever? I'm sure maybe some people could, but the average node operator is probably running on a public cloud. Now Ethereum as well, most of it is running on public clouds, but theoretically if this type of attack from a state level actor happened, then you could easily transition to a smaller server, just a computer or a Raspberry Pi or a phone or whatever. So it just makes it more resilient. The reason we're here is because we want decentralization and we want self-sovereignty. We don't want to rely on intermediary parties. And the public cloud infrastructure is a big, big, especially for the alternative L1s, is a big point of failure. Like if the US government or, I'm not saying this again, I believe in America has sensible regulation. We'll have sensible regulation and, we all believe in freedom and we can lobby for this to never happen. But, you never know, like some dictator could just, go in there and say crypto's illegal, Google, whatever, ban it. And that'll be the end of these alt L1s. But, Ethereum can still continue operating. Bitcoin can continue operating. This stuff we must not lose. Or even like, again, like if World War III broke out or whatever, like who's to say that the public cloud infrastructure will maintain, whereas like, people could still run servers in their homes or, you know, in their cars or whatever. But yeah.
Oh yeah, China is definitely keeping a hold on it. I know they're banning the use.
Exactly. Yeah, China is a good example of a state level actor trying to attack Bitcoin. They literally banned Bitcoin mining, and there was a essentially a migration of Bitcoin miners to like Kazakhstan and like Central Asia, because it was literally illegal to mine Bitcoin in China, and Bitcoin was resilient. You know, it lived through it. If anything, you know, it became stronger because of it. And that just goes to show, like, Bitcoin can withstand a huge state level actor attack, like various. I mean, how many times has Bitcoin been banned in China? Whereas, like, you know, if one of these blockchains has, you know, a third of their servers running on Alibaba Cloud or something, and then, you know, China banned that, then that would impact its liveness or its security. So, yeah, I think it's important. Like, people shouldn't lose sight of the principles of blockchain and why we need decentralization.
Yeah, and they just need to realize, like, if you can't beat them, join them. You know, you're just like, because people are going to use it regardless if you say they can or cannot. But yeah, man, thanks for coming on the show. Did you feel like there's anything you want to go over that we didn't cover before we sign off, or anything you want to share to the general public?
Yeah, this is good. You know, people should educate themselves more on crypto, more on the principles. Definitely recommend reading Satoshi's white paper. It's really short. It's only a few pages. That's kind of like the Bible for crypto. And, you know, even though Solana and all these alternative L1s and projects are hot, and, you know, cool and probably giving out free airdrops and all this stuff, like, you know, stick to the principles, be humble. You know, look at Bitcoin, Ethereum as the North Stars for where we should go. And yeah, continue supporting your devs and using these products and being part of these communities. That's what makes us strong. But yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, man, it's always an honor and pleasure. And I wish you the best with your endeavors. And hey, who knows, maybe a few months or a year from now, we could catch up and you could update us.
Awesome. Perfect, again. Thank you for having me.
All right, man. Have a good night or day, wherever you're at.
Thank you. Take care. All right.
Just stay on.